Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Memes, The Guardian's regular podcast from Brexitland, and I'm John Henley. At the end of this week, Theresa May will make what was billed in advance as the third big policy statement laying out the government's overarching vision of Brexit, after her Lancaster House speech in January and the Brexit white paper that followed. So a time, one might think, for ministers to rally round and project an image of assurance and unity about the whole project, particularly since, as you'll know if you're a regular listener to this pod, negotiations haven't been going entirely swimmingly of late. Instead, though, the Prime Minister's Foreign Secretary delivered himself of a 4,000-word essay, painting a lyrically enthusiastic but often exaggerated, contradictory and occasionally downright inaccurate picture of the glorious future awaiting Britain after it had escaped the gigantic and ever-tightening cat's cradle of red tape that is the EU after Brexit, the country's great new national enterprise in which, of course, it would succeed mightily. To be fair to Boris Johnson, he backed the Prime Minister's core red lines: an exit from the single market and the customs union, and an end to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. But he had nothing to say on a transitional deal, and he rejected any notion of paying the EU for the right to trade with it. Which was a shame, because under the influence of Chancellor Philip Hammond, the cabinet had seemed to be edging towards precisely that kind of gradualist arrangement, certainly for a 2 to 3 year interim period, during which most things would stay pretty much the same, and the final relationship could be sorted out. So, what is Boris playing at? How divided is the cabinet really? Or is this just the Foreign Secretary playing Tory party politics? How has it all gone down in Europe? And what implications might it have for the Prime Minister's Florence speech? With me to discuss these burning Brexit questions are The Guardian's Deputy Political Editor Rowena Mason in Westminster and Brussels Bureau Chief Dan Boffey. Rowena, starting with you. Now, a lot of the focus on Boris's article was on that infamous £350 million a week claim. I don't really want to get into that because it's all so demonstrably wrong. And incidentally, I see that just this morning, the IFS has punched another hole in it. It says that far from having 350 million quid a week extra available for public spending on anything at all, the UK is actually more likely to experience a fiscal loss as a result of Brexit. But that aside, what do you think's going on here? Is it possible to distinguish, a sort of a pure personal ambition on the part of Boris from this hard Brexit resistance movement inside the government?
I think it's very difficult to disentangle those two things, because for Boris Johnson, his personal ambition is very much bound up with whether Brexit is a success in his eyes or not. And what I think the Telegraph article over the weekend was doing for Boris Johnson was he was hitting back at what he sees is Brexit taking a wrong course as it is steered by Theresa May and Philip Hammond and to some extent David Davis. He feels that this softer Brexit approach of maintaining the status quo won't be radical enough when it comes to voters being satisfied that Brexit is exactly what they wanted and they voted for. He sees it as not being positive enough. He's worried that this promise that the vote Leave gave to give £350 million to the NHS won't be honoured. And whatever you think about the rights and wrongs of those figures, he, I think, would argue that the government should give some consideration to promising whatever's left over from, if there's anything left over from clawing money back from Brussels after Brexit, that should be promised for the NHS.
Yeah,
some sort of nod towards what that campaign was arguing for. And on the other side, you've got Philip Hammond, who would probably argue that Theresa May and Philip Hammond weren't the ones making those promises. It's really Boris's problem, and that's the bed that he's got to lie in. And he didn't go for the leadership last year, so he doesn't necessarily get so much of a say in the direction that Brexit should be going. But for Boris personally, I think he does still harbour some ambitions to be leader of the Conservative Party. And if those are ever to come to fruition for him, he's going to want the public to think that Brexit's being carried out in the fashion that Vote Leave promised, and he's worried that it is all going wrong for him.
Right.
If it goes on for much longer in this direction, he thinks people will be disappointed, and in his chance of becoming leader will fade.
Yeah. And how much support does that view have in the cabinet, and critically also, I suppose, in Parliament?
But at the beginning, when the article was first published, it looked like it was only supported by a very, very few hardliners like Jacob Rees-Mogg and Ian Duncan-Smith and Nadine Dorries. But as the days have gone by, Michael Gove has sort of reluctantly shown his hand and tentatively backed Boris Johnson, despite their falling out over the leadership last year when Michael Gove scuppered Johnson's chances of being leader. It does look very much like there is a coordinated Vote Leave effort to mobilise, to defend the principles of that winning campaign from last year, which they feel are being betrayed by the kind of direction that Brexit is going in at the moment. And that puts Theresa May in a very difficult position for her speech on Friday.
Absolutely, yeah.
She might have been trying to move towards a softer Brexit position, a more concessionary position where she was offering things to Brussels, but it's been made very clear that Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, potentially people like Ian Duncan-Smith as well, are lining up on the other side to say, don't you dare.
Right. That is, yeah, exactly. Leaves her, indeed, as you say, in a very, very tricky position. Dan, how's that all playing in Europe? I mean, for the EU27, surely it looks pretty much convincing further evidence that the UK is basically still arguing with itself over what kind of Brexit it actually wants. On the other hand, I suppose in Europe, they know Boris quite well.
They do know him very well from his time as a Brussels correspondent for The Telegraph. He's also had a reputation for rather embellishing stories, sort of colourful yarns about regulations of bananas and such. So, yes, he has a bit of a toxic reputation. I understand the French foreign minister, for example, pretended not to be able to speak any English for the first few months of their relationship, just to put him on edge. he's not well liked. So that's factored in. When they hear Boris Johnson talking, they know the politics of it all, and they factor it in and think, well, that's not the British government speaking, that's Boris Johnson. We know about Boris Johnson. But a few things that, in the substance of what he was saying in his article, and the very fact that it does seem like the Vote Leave are sort of coordinating and trying to make more of themselves in the Brexit debate within the cabinet, a few of the substance bits that do alarm them is that there was a suggestion that there could be regulatory divergence. So Boris was saying that in time we will diverge from the EU body of law to be a sort of more low regulation economy.
Yes, I mean, he promised, and it was a very contradictory promise, wasn't it? I mean, he said that British regulation would be absolutely in line with EU regulations, and it sort of pretty much three breaths later said that Britain would become a pioneer in kind of, you know, looser regulation.
Yeah, it was, and it's absolutely what the EU side have been saying the whole time about, oh, you want to leave the single market but have sort of frictionless access to it. Well, you can't if you're going to change your body of law. If you have lower standards in various things, then we need to check as goods come through the borders. And we understand that once you leave the EU, there will be divergence. So that was what they always said to the British, and then Boris Johnson's confirmed it. He said, yeah, and then we will diverge and we'll be low regulated. So that set off alarm bells. It seems to sort of reverse all the stuff that Hammond and others were talking about, a kind of status quo in the transition period, and then after that being as close as possible to the EU acquis, that seems to have changed. Then the money thing, what they will like is the fact that Boris talked about settling the accounts. So that's good. They like that sort of that mood music. Mm. They don't like, well, some of the EU member states are quite hawkish about the idea that if you continue to have access to single market at status quo, a bit of a, we'll fudge it legally so you can Britain continue during a transition period to have access to single market. Well, they're going to have to pay for that because everybody else does. It's part of making the single market work properly that money goes to the Eastern Central European states to make sure they're sort of they're up to standard. So that's going to upset people. But I think that the bigger problem is not even substance. It's the further evidence, as you say, John, of the British don't know what they're doing. There's the Tory, it's the latest incarnation of the Tory infighting that's led us to Brexit. Where it will take Britain next and where it will force the EU to go next, we don't know.
Yeah.
Can the British government be trusted when it makes decisions, when Theresa May makes assurances during negotiations? Well, can they be trusted? Because this British government looks like it could collapse at any moment. So those are the concerns. And then, of course, they want to move on. This is incredibly frustrating. This is months and months and months, 15 months since the referendum result. Jean-Claude Juncker did his State of the Union speech last week, saying how we're going to move on, we've got bigger priorities. This is a bit of a headache. They want this to be done. So those are the concerns from Boris's.
I think there was a suggestion, wasn't there, this week from one European think tank that things might be getting to the stage where the EU is actually going to have to sort of lay out options for Britain to choose from because it appears to be completely incapable of coming up with a coherent position. Is that likely, do you think?
I don't think that's likely because it would take an awful lot of organising for the EU27 to agree on each of those options. I mean, if you look at just the Article 50 guidelines, that took a lot. Yeah, they boasted about it taking 4 minutes to agree, but that was the signing at the end summit. It took a lot of work of the various Sherpas from the various capitals coming together, trying to agree on this is how we agree things will move forward. And this is what our position on these various areas. To actually do that for sort of the various different options would be, I think,
almost impossible.
So, yeah, almost impossible. So I think, no, it's also British. I mean, Barnier said about the Irish problem, you broke it, you fix it. And it's for the British to come up with a response. And actually, the EU, as I say, they feel like they've moved on. They don't want to be spending all their time trying to help Britain along. They've got they're starting their trade negotiations with Australia and New Zealand. They've got other things to do. So
That's probably not going to be a plan. Okay. Rowena, there's been a bit of talk since the weekend, hasn't there, of the Prime Minister sort of trying to take back control of the process. So we're told Boris isn't going to be sacked. He might be sort of politely asked to toe the line. Another possible sign, Ollie Robbins, who's, of course, the UK's chief negotiator in the Brexit talks, has been moved across to the Cabinet Office after what was said to be sort of tensions with the Brexit Secretary, David Davis. How strong is the Prime Minister? Will she be capable of stamping her authority, what authority she has on Brexit? And how accurate do you think this picture that we're being given in the media, at least, of sort of complete chaos behind the scenes? How accurate is that?
I think the chaos is a more accurate representation than Theresa May being in charge of things and stamping her authority and ordering cabinet ministers to dutifully toe the line. Because the reality is she is in a very weak position when it comes to Boris Johnson. She can't sack him quite at the moment because she's worried that if she does so, that would trigger a leadership challenge. In fact, the Boris article at the weekend was almost daring her to do so. And so she's really got to sort of put up with this insubordination and even possibly go so far as to negotiate with him and the other vote leavers to see what would satisfy them in terms of a compromise. And it makes it much more difficult for her to go down a soft Brexit concessionary path when she makes this keynote speech on Friday. So we were expecting her to make a financial offer to Brussels and say, this is what we'd like to contribute and this is how long we'd like to contribute for.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very difficult. Boris Johnson said that wouldn't be acceptable to him. there's a, now a distinct possibility that we might hear something really quite boring and a repeat of the Lancaster House speech.
Just another sort of set of bromides.
Exactly, a Brexit means Brexit speech. Having decided that she'd fly out to Florence to give this great big set piece.
And actually it's going to be a damp squib.
Well, I think she's going to have to announce something. But whether she will be brave enough to stand up to Boris Johnson and the other vote leavers, because it isn't just him. I mean, it is Michael Gove is behind him to some extent. People like Priti Patel, because she's kept quiet publicly, but is likely to be of a similar mindset. So she's in a very, very tricky position. She's saying that she issued a sort of mild rebuke of Boris Johnson when she was in Canada yesterday, saying that she was driving the car in reference to Amber Rudd's claim that Boris Johnson was backseat driving.
What she can concretely do, she's very constrained.
She is very constrained, yes. It's not entirely within her control which direction she's being told to go.
Right. Dan, just on that Ollie Robbins question, will he be missed in the negotiations? Will his disappearance make a difference, or his sort of reassignment make a difference in Brussels?
I understand, actually, that he will be here. So the officials at CREPA insisting nothing's changed. He's not been sacked. He's not quit. He's just a new boss. And he will be just as involved as he was previously, but this time be a bit more of a tribune, it would seem, for the Prime Minister, which is strengthening her hand. And that's actually quite reassuring to the EU, because he's well-liked, he's well-known. I know sort of the very highest levels of the Commission, they were actually quite hopeful that he, right at the beginning, that he would be the chief negotiator rather than Davis. They thought, from their position, Robbins understands the realities, as they would put it, of the situation.
Yeah, it's sort of a safer pair of hands for them than David Davis.
For them, anyway, yeah. I mean, whether...
All right. Rowena, you've said that it's actually now very difficult for us to say what might be in the Prime Minister's speech. I suppose the other factor that will play into what she's able to say is the fact that it's only a very short time before the Conservative Party conference, isn't it? How much will that weigh on her mind in the speech that she gives on Friday?
I expect it'll be weighing hugely on her mind. I think part of the point of this speech was to try and stamp her authority on Brexit before the party conference, get ahead of the game and stop all the leadership speculation and complaints about the direction that Brexit's going by setting out her stall before party conference. But if she doesn't have much to announce on Friday, then or indeed if Boris Johnson's very unhappy with what she announces on Friday, we could see some real high drama in the weeks to come.
And Dan, what do you think the Europeans are expecting from this Florence talk? What would they, I mean, in an ideal world, what would they like to hear, and what do they fear they might hear?
Well, I don't think they're expecting much. I mean, they have sort of, they're going to comment on it, which they don't usually comment on, sort of Brexit shenanigans on the other side of the channel, but they're preparing to comment on it. And I know that there was, Guy Verhofstadt was going to have a right go at Theresa May for ducking out, talking to the whole European Parliament, but then he decided not to because of the Florence speech, because he was hopeful that it was going to actually provide some substance and move things on. But I think in reality, actually, the last few days has reduced expectations. They hope would be that Theresa May would say, right, we accept the sequencing, because they initially accepted the sequencing, then they stopped accepting the sequencing and said, well, we need to talk about the future now. They would love the UK to say, look, we're going to sit down and do as we promised right at the start and accept the sequencing, make progress on these three issues.
Sort Article 50 out first before the future.
Exactly. And but maybe just say, look, yes, we've got a bit bogged down, so we understand it's going to take until December, but we are going to sort these three issues and give that promise. Then they would hope, and I think maybe this was the initial intention from Downing Street, was to explain a bit more what the transition period would look like. I mean, Hammond had gone some way on that. Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister had talked about it as well, the status quo, essentially. Mm. That would be great. And then say, not necessarily spell out on the money what you're going to hand over, but actually say, and we are going to make a proposal on the methodology and the money. Because currently, what's irritating the EU side is that the negotiation of the money involves EU setting out what they want, and the British then interrogating that position and questioning it and sort of saying, no, that's, we don't legally allow that. It's kind of not a negotiation. It's more just a sort of Q&A.
A nitpicking exercise rather than...
And that's, and what they want from the British is, okay, we've done our interrogation and here is what our methodology would be. And then from that, when you've got two opposing papers, then you can sort of make some progress. But that they would hope Theresa May would indicate that that's where she's going to go. I mean, it seems extremely unlikely. But, you know, this sort of position needs, this impasse needs to be broken. So I think she needs to do something.
Something will need to be done. OK, well, we shall see. We'll find out in a few days' time. That's about it for this week. Thank you very much, Rowena in Westminster, Dan in Brussels, for joining me. Next week, Brexit Means, we'll be marking 6 months since Article 50 was triggered. And we're going to attempt a bit of a catch-up exercise on where things stand and what to expect next. If you have any specific questions, do please email us. It's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word. brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Please subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers. Till next week then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.